I knew that I either could go to school and stay in college and get a degree and get my job, or I could go find something else, another vehicle that would allow me to kind of channel the same discipline.
Welcome to the Multifamily Wealth Podcast. I'm your host, Axel Ragnarsson, and on this show, I dissect how seasoned multifamily investors started, built, and scaled their businesses. What's going on, everybody? Welcome back to another episode here on the Multifamily Wealth Podcast. In this episode, I'm chatting with a young investor based in Tampa, Florida. Gabe Bowling is who I have on the show today. And Gabe's got a very interesting story. Got his real estate license at a young age, went and did a stint at Marcus & Millichap. And then he did a couple of years at Cardone Capital, where he was helping Grant's private equity team actually raise capital. We obviously get into that in this episode a little bit. So a very interesting story where he spent a couple of years there and then left to go start his own real estate business, buying mid to large multifamily properties throughout Florida. And he's done some deals in other markets as well. And he's also the founder of a really interesting community called The Deal Room, which is an educational community centered around multifamily investing. And in this episode, we have just a really interesting conversation around the different roadmaps, or the different roads, I should say, that you can take into multifamily private equity and actually starting a multifamily private equity business. We also talk a lot about joint venturing versus trying to do larger deals right off the bat, and the different ways you can actually build one of these businesses. We also talk about Florida, since he's a Florida investor and he lives in Florida, and all the challenges that are apparent in Florida right now as it relates to doing deals and where he's seeing opportunity. And we spend some time talking about capital raising as well and how he's actually building out his capital funnel to get new investors into his business. So this is a very helpful episode, a very value-packed episode, as well as a really interesting one as well, because we talk a lot about, you know, Grant Cardone and his infrastructure, and whether you like him or not, probably the best capital raiser in terms of raising retail capital that there is in the entire real estate business. My feelings on him are lukewarm, but I think that there's a lot of interesting conversation to be had around how he's built his business. And we also spend a lot of time talking about how Gabe has gotten his business off the ground as he's branched out on his own. So this is certainly going to be an episode that you take something away from. So be sure to listen to this one all the way through. And if you do learn something, if you do take something away from it, please consider leaving the show a 5-star rating and review, as it helps it get in front of more folks. And always appreciate seeing those reviews comes in, because we know the show is growing as a result. But thanks again for listening to the podcast. I'm going to catch you guys on the next episode. What's going on, everybody? Welcome back to another episode here on the Multifamily Wealth Podcast. As you just heard in the intro that I put together, we got a great guest this week, Mr. Gabe Bowling, a young investor who is doing a lot of great things here. He's got his hands on a bunch of different things, growing a business, growing a great community of multifamily investors that I'm sure we'll touch on at some point in this episode. And I think he also has the best Instagram handle of anyone in real estate, which I didn't bring up to you before you record, but I'm very jealous of it. Just at multifamily is about as good as it gets. Yeah, well, I want to hear the story, but before we get into all that, Gabe, how about you share a little bit about your background, maybe how you got into this business, maybe rewind however many years ago you want to go here, and then we'll work from there.
Cool. Yeah. So first off, thank you. I am a fan. I've actually listened to this podcast prior to being on it. So thank you for having me.
Love it. Appreciate it.
I'll start where I'm at currently. I'm 26 years old. We run the Deal Room community and Bowling Capital. That's the main two focuses. Today, Bowling Capital retains ownership in about $45 million of deals. That's 309 units across Florida and Missouri. And we've broken off, I'll get to it. I broke off from working at Cardone Capital 2 years ago. So that's kind of where we're at today. That's our main focus, 26, doing a bunch of cool stuff, I think. Definitely didn't start there. I grew up in the middle class, military family. My father's a special forces Green Beret, been in for 27 years. I grew up in a very disciplined, I wouldn't say disciplined, but very structured household in just the middle class. So I went to school, got good grades, played baseball, played football my entire life, team oriented, trying to develop a leadership kind of role. That was my parenting and childhood growing up. Life hit me when I was 18 to 19, when I wasn't good enough at baseball or football to get a college degree or a scholarship to go play. And I kind of had to grow up, because that's literally my entire life, baseball, football, and go to school, get good grades. Cool. And I got into bodybuilding. That's where I kind of found discipline. That was like the first thing of like, okay, what am I doing with my life? This is 18, 19. I get into really good shape and I'm like, man, this is awesome. If you just channel all of the discipline into one thing, you can actually get really good and you can get the outcome of it. However, I was super broke. I was really shredding, like had a six pack and everything, but I was super broke. Didn't really cut it. I was still living with the parents and it was cool, but it wasn't a career and I didn't really have anything going for it. So I knew that I either could go to school and stay in college and get a degree and get my job, or I could go find something else, another vehicle that would allow me to kind of channel the same discipline. Cause I'm a very, I think a lot of real estate investors have this personality of like, if you're going to do something, it's either going to be all the way in or all the way in. I think it's a common character trait you run into with a lot of investors. So for me, I was like, what's that thing that I could get really good at? I went to Google because that school was not an option for me. I hated school. I technically have an AA. It sounds better if I just say I dropped out. I went to Google. I kid you not. I literally went to Google and I said, what career fields can you make the most money in without a college degree? Real estate, automotive, insurance, and some other BS like that. I was like, okay, insurance, don't want to do it. Automotive, really don't want to do it. May as well do this real estate thing. I do what every other person in the world does, which is go and get their real estate license. I fail three times. I passed on the fourth time. And money still did not show up in the bank account, surprisingly. I thought all I had to do was pass a test. And then I got introduced into the world of sales and like marketing and like, you know, real business and how the business works. Nobody would hire me. I was 20. I had no experience. I had no money. I had no real value to like any company other than the fact that I could work for free. So I grew up in the middle class. I was living with my parents and I looked at myself. I'm like, why would any employer ever give me an opportunity? It's not because I have the experience. It's just because I'll show up. I'll do all the terrible stuff that nobody really wants to do and I'll do it for free if I can just have the experience and be around the right people. So that was kind of like my first break of momentum. I got hired by Marcus Millichap. And if your listeners are active, you guys know who Marcus Millichap is. Reputation aside, it's a good firm, but it was a really good experience for me because it was the first time that I was around people who were making $1 million a year or, you know, $5 million a year running a very successful brokerage and then selling to investors. It was just getting the exposure was everything that I really needed to hit the ground running. I worked there for free for a year. I didn't get paid a single dime. I didn't close any deals. I did all the grunt work, the underwriting, the comps, the phone calls, the stupid stuff, database, CR, like all of the stuff nobody who was actually producing and making money wanted to do. That was my job. And I knew what a cap rate was. That's all. I could do all the grunt work and I knew what a cap rate was. I say that because I worked there for 11 months and 20 something days. I just say a year until I got a post from my wife, actually, saying that Cardone Capital was hiring. At the time, I wasn't following Grant. I actually thought he was annoying and that he posted way too much on Instagram. It's funny how full circle that thing comes back. Now I'm the annoying person. But she sent me the post and I'm like, interesting. Here's this opportunity where I could go down to Miami, make money. That was probably the number one reason we took the job, so I could actually make money and move out and, you know, create a life and then learn directly from Grant. And it was early enough. I started in Fund 3. So it was an early company or early enough to raising money from retail investors where I was able to get close enough to Grant because we were the front lines and management of expectations to the investors. So I was role-playing every morning with them, role-playing with Ryan and getting very close to the deals. And the smallest deal that I worked on was $50 million. The largest was $750 million. So it was like, I stumbled into the opportunity. I took it for the money and just, to get out of the house. But I ended up stumbling into arguably the greatest business that exists, real estate or private equity real estate. That was my next little win or break, I guess you could say. I worked for free. I call it the trenches. You got to spend some time there. And I put the time in there and I got some experience. I knew what cap rate was. That's what Marcus will teach you. And then it was good timing. I think it was luck. Grant just needed to fill chairs and have people that would make phone calls 12 to 14 hours a day. And hungry. And so I fit the build and I just had a smidge bit of experience that I could leverage to land the job at Grant's office. That's what a lot of people know me for today. I raised $100 million there when I was there for 3 years total. $102 million was the actual number that was raised. It was 50 grand, 100 grand, 500 grand, 250, a million at a time. There's a lot of retail investors that are accredited, non-accredited, like everybody. And then the deal side of it. That was the most fun part. That's why I ended up leaving. I became, you know, I think everybody either develop that bug for like, I want to do deals, I'm a deal maker, or you're going to go into another business and make a lot of money and then invest in an LP. I got that deal bug and I had to make a decision on whether or not I wanted to be the investor relations salesperson that was just having the same conversation over and over and over, making a decent amount of money, or, you know, take this big, you know, leap and quit and give up this the golden handcuff opportunity and then go out and try to build what we have today and what will be continue to be built over the next 30 years, which is Bullion Capital. So that's kind of like I know it was a little bit long formed answer to it, but again, I like to dig deep into the details and open up kind of wherever, because, you know, I really don't know what's going to help the most here, whether it's on the front end of it, getting started, or, you know, quitting, making 250 grand a year at Grant's office and what that was like. So I figure I share it all.
Yeah, no, that's great, man. It's a hell of a story. And it's funny, your comments about being doing your year stint at Marcus, you know, I know so many folks and the acquisitions manager in our real estate business I don't know if he did a year. I think maybe he did like 6 months at Marcus, but yeah. He left with a lot of the same comments you just made, where it's like, it was very helpful. It was great training, very good sales training. And it's like, you're just thrown into the deep end and you figure it out and you either become a broker and you do a high volume, or you take some of those skills and you apply it to a different segment of the real estate business. So it's interesting. And I think a lot of younger folks, right? If you're in your early 20s and you're trying to get into real estate, even if you're not trying to be a broker, I mean, maybe you don't tell Marcus this when you join the brokerage, but even if you're not looking to be a broker long-term, there's a lot of valuable training that comes with being involved in that type of a business, whether it's Marcus or another kind of high-pressure, high-performing brokerage. But so I could dive into a bunch of stuff about Grant. I want to talk about kind of a couple of higher-level things here, more as it relates to working at an institutional-level shop and what that allows you to do when you leave a business like that, the experience that you develop, and then when you strike out on your own. And an interesting dynamic that I've noticed in the overall real estate business, the real estate private equity business, I should say, is, you know, there's really kind of two lanes that people follow to get in there. You have a lot of people that work at a large real estate shop that strike out on their own and then start a version of that, a smaller version that they then look to grow. Or you get people, and this is kind of how I got into the business, where, you know, you're buying a couple of duplexes, then you buy a 5-unit, then you buy a 10-unit, and then you realize you got to go raise money, and then you organically slowly grow, and you kind of just learn about all this crap on the fly as you go. And it takes a little bit longer, but you grow in a bit of a different way. Whereas people that come out of institutional businesses, I've noticed, typically jump into larger deals, or they have a comfort level of doing larger deals a little bit more quickly. You know, they don't leave and then go follow the path myself, right? It's not typically the roadmap. So, first of all, just a question, because I'm curious. Were you making like outbound calls to investors when you were working at Cardone Capital? You were taking inbound calls from like interested investors in a specific opportunity and qualifying business, closing business? Like, what did your actual day-to-day look like?
Yeah. So, whenever you have a grant, I'll answer this question under Grant's perspective, and then I'll also answer it under my perspective, because we're replicating the same model as far as like the funnel and getting people in and whatnot. They're all inbound and they all know who Grant is. They all know, they all follow him. They all raise their hand and say, I'm interested, because whenever you can cast a net to 15 million people and you only need, I shouldn't say only, but you know, we're raising 50 to 100 million per deal and we raise $50 million in a month. Like not that crazy, because the net's just that wide and so many people know who Grant is. Most people can't do that. So
love him or hate him. And I'm sorry for interrupting. Like, whether you like GC or not, like, he's the greatest capital raiser there is as it relates to raising retail capital, bar none. There's a lot of things you can learn from a guy like that. Yeah.
Unfathomable what's pulled off and how many institutional people, how much attention he's gotten from the bigger players that actually run the community or the actual industry, where it's never been done before. It's just literally never been done before. I was there. I started when it was 150 to 200 million raised as collectively as a company. And then I left when it was 900 million. I think they're like 1.4 or something. It's It is incredible to raise that much money from a retail investor. So yes, I agree with you. Everything was inbound, with the exception, it could be like an accredited lead goes to the portal and they sign up for the portal. And then I see that they're accredited. So I'm going to call them, hey, thanks for signing up. What questions did you have to help get you invested? Versus an inbound text like, hey, I have a new deal, text invest to 305, whatever it is. And then that lead comes in. Oh, yep, they really raise their hand versus I just raised my hand a little bit. I'm going to sign up for the portal. So it's just treating those leads. It really is a sales and marketing funnel. It's not the same conversations that you're having with like a high pressure $1,000 course that you're trying to have a conversation with a $100,000 investment. It's a little bit different, but the fundamental of like having a funnel with the, you know, showing interest, who's interested, come in, perfect. Let's have a conversation. Let's get clear on what it is.
Got it. Now, were there any other things you took away from the experience of working there, whether it was related to capital raising, whether it was related to the pursuit of larger assets, working with maybe a guy like Grant or the other people in the office that have kind of stuck with you as you've started your own business? You've obviously done a few deals. We're going to talk about those at some point here in this conversation. Anything else you took from that experience that's notable that you'd like to share?
There's so many things. I don't think I could unpack all of it on a podcast. Take full responsibility for everything that happens to your entire life. That's probably like the number one thing. The way I look, I got my MBA in life, business, real estate, marketing, like everything there. And I got paid to do it. That was one of the greatest opportunities that I ever had and probably will have to work there. I would say being honest, even like being in a position where if you mess up or you mismanage expectations on a call with an investor and they send a wire going into a deal thinking it's going to be this. And then you're like, man, the debt just changed. The treasuries went up 50 basis points. And now the returns that I thought the investor was going to get, so now it's just completely changed. You have to make the call. It's like, hey, I know I told you this, but it's actually this versus, you know, not telling them at all. And you can be okay with it. Like nothing happens. So you figure it out later. I don't know. It's doing the right thing and having integrity. Like I saw Grant make some very tough decisions that took money out of his own pocket to make sure that this person was good. And that's, unfortunately, nobody will see that because of how big he is. Being like on the inside, having the integrity and doing the right thing, that I've come across being in the ecosystem. You see how Grant operates. And then, you know, you meet a lot of wealthy people that do very well. You also see a lot of bad actors in the industry and you see what they do. And it's like, man, the LP out there, there's a lot of LPs. I've had 3 phone calls in the last week where LPs are losing money in their deal and the operator is doing a capital call. And they're like, hey, man, I just don't know what to do. Like, how do I know if I'm doing or throwing good money on bad money? Like, I have no idea. I don't know. I just see a lot of people, the tighter the environment's getting, you're seeing questionable decisions from operators. And I think integrity and doing the right thing is really important, especially if you're early on in your career. Like I look at it, we've done 3 deals now and it's been 2 years since I left there. I look at this phase as the infancy stage of like a 5-year infancy stage to a 50-year business. And so like I'm trying to make decisions that will impact the 50-year-old version of this company. Most people can't even think like 60 days from now.
Mm-hmm. 100%. No, I mean, it's, you know, and it's really challenging to think about how you can handle those challenging situations unless one of 2 things happens, right? You either deal with it and it's real life experience, you go through it, you're figuring it out on the fly and you have these conversations with investors and you try to do your best, right? In terms of you learning how to do that. Or 2, you witness how someone did it well or did it wrong, right? And then you can at least reference somebody else's approach to having a bad conversation, whether it's, hey, I know we missed our target for this quarter, or hey, you know, our K1s are coming out late, or this or that, or whatever it is, whether it's mine or large, it's always helpful if you can reference how somebody else handles that, which I think is a real advantage of people who start their own real estate private equity business that have worked in one that has been around for a while, that has experience at those doing deals at scale, raising capital at scale, because you just have the playbook, right? You know, the hardest thing about growing a business.
I apologize. I forgot to answer the first question, the JV and the smaller deal pathway versus the syndication pathway. You just touched on it. So we run our community. I'm the perfect child poster boy to scream and market syndications that you should go out and syndicate a 100-unit deal for your first deal. I'm actually not the biggest believer of that, like at all, even though technically I've done it. That's super cool. I also worked at Grant's office for 3 years and I raised $100 million and I went through 19 transactions, not with my last name on the paper, but it's a different thing. So I think for a lot of people getting in and you're at a job making $75,000 a year, and you're just trying to figure out how you can build a portfolio to get to $10,000 a month or $20,000 a month. Syndications is not like, sure, it's a pathway you can take. It's a low probability, high effort, high driven, and like really hard to break into if you've never done it and you have no experience and you can't leverage somebody else's track record. Like, yeah, I worked at Grant's office. That was cool. It wasn't the reason that I was able to raise. I raised $1 million for my first deal at 24 when I broke off. I had another partner involved that had experience in, had gone full cycle, that I had the leverage. Like, that was the only way that I actually raised money. So it was very hard. So probability wise, I'm a much bigger believer for most people, unless you're at Blackstone or Starwood or KKR, and like you're already in the PE world. For most people, starting with a 4-unit or starting with an 8-unit or a 10-unit with, if you're a flipper, like I see a lot of flippers transition, they're doing 10 flips a year and then they go and they switch to a 12-unit apartment complex. I'm like, that's not that crazy of a jump for you to turn 18 unit or 12 units, whatever the number of units is. I like that jump. But to go from one single family home flip to syndicating a 214-unit deal with never operating it, never raising capital, it's just, is it possible? Yes, the probability is much lower. I'd rather you focus time on smaller deals.
Yeah, and you're absolutely preaching to the choir. And everyone who listens to this knows that's
good.
Well, one, that's my story, so obviously I'm biased, right? But I think, you know, I think the gym is a perfect analogy for this, right? Like, you don't walk into the gym on the first day, you've never been to the gym, and you try to bench, you know, 285, like, that's not going to work, right? Bar is going to come down on your chest. You're not going to be able to lift it up. A bunch of people are going to be coming to your rescue. And in reality, a lot of people syndicated deals that had never been to the gym before, so to speak, right? And those deals, a lot of people are coming to the rescue right now. And it's just a much more sustainable way. If you want to do this, is you either, you know, go to the gym and you put up 135, right? And you do it for a couple of reps, right? That's the theoretical equivalent to buying that 4-unit, buying that 8-unit, whatever that next step is for you in your personal real estate journey, but also your personal financial journey. And it's like, okay, if you're going to go in there and you're going to try to lift a bunch of weight, you're going to need a bunch of people spotting you, helping you lift that weight, right? So it's, if you're going to go do that big deal, you're going to have a small percentage of whatever the
promote they carry. Yeah.
And see, carried interest isn't going to be that meaningful at all. And it's a lot harder to even to wedge yourself into a transaction like that than it is to go buy a duplex, you know, that somebody lists in your marketplace, or that you go do a little bit of direct to seller on and you get a good deal. And that also has a much more meaningful impact to your personal financial situation, owning the entirety of a deal like that, because you can control it.
I'll give you a perk, because I'm a big believer in data and quantification. I like, show me the deal, show me the address, show me the rent roll, show me all of it. We have two deals going on right this second inside of our community. One syndicated, it's a 144-unit deal in Dallas. The person who's the GP on it is a part of the capital raising team. There's 16 or 17 different GPs there. I don't like this deal. I'll be very open about it. I don't like the deal. They'll retain less than 1% of the carry, or less than 1% of the total deal. They'll have 2 or 3 points of the carried interest, and their act fee is going to be $5,000 for raising $500,000 because of the way that these carried interests and GP structures are set up. And then I also have a 10-unit deal going on in Ocala that's being bought for $975. It closes next week. $97,000 a unit, and they're putting $10,000 into it. It's about $150,000 of rehab cost total. They're in for 1.1. It should be 1.8 to 2 in 12 to 18 months. That guy's going to pick up $600,000. And then the person that gets to call themselves the GP, they pick up $5,000. What sounds better? Being the syndicator and being able to market the whole, you know, shebang. What actually hits the bank is what matters. That's why I'm a big believer. Like, you know, we retain a pretty sizable chunk of the carried interest on these deals because we can raise a lot of money. Most people can't.
Yeah. And, you know, the quick version of, and I've done this in previous podcast episodes, like the really quick math is like, let's say you got a 5-unit or a 50-unit, you know, you're buying the 5-unit for $100,000 a door, pay $500,000, you sell it in a few years for 6. know, leaving out all the closing costs and all this stuff. Let's just simplify, right? You make $100,000 as an investor. That's great. Yeah. Okay. So let's go say you buy the 50 unit for $5 million, right? And you do a, you raise $1 million, 80 LTV, right? Let's just simple numbers. You sell it for the six. There's a profit of $1 million. You give $1 million back to your investors. You got, you know, you pay off your loan of four. You give $1 million back. You got a profit of $1 million. You split that 70-30 or whatever it is. You're taking home 300 as a GP. But
that's if you retain 100% of it.
And exactly. And that's the big thing is you're probably going to need someone to sign the debt. So you're going to give them a percentage. You probably need someone to help you raise the money. So you give them a percentage. You probably need someone to help you actually operate it. So you give them a percentage. Maybe you have a third of that upside. So you make $100,000. What's harder to do? It's just much easier to go buy the five unit, right?
You learn so much more through doing the five too. It's a quicker period of time. Physical. Yeah, there's a lot of reasons. And there's probably a lot of, you know, they're out there. But that's the whole thing with the syndication model and the big gurus out there that teach it. You know, I saw Grant's thing for $25,000. I know the existing structure that for the GP structures that exist. If you really looked at the breakout, they'll allocate 20 to 30% of the total carried interest, meaning of the, if it's an 80-20 of the 20, they're going to allocate 5 points of it to a $10 million equity raise. And you little capital raiser are going to ring $250,000 to $500,000 from your grandma that you've been, you know, begging for money for 10 years. And you're going to own 5% of 5% of 100%. And so you end up getting diluted fairly quick. That's again why I'm not the biggest fan of it, even though I'm doing it. Like it's,
yeah, and I'm doing it myself as well. Right. And it's like, you know, and it's funny because that $5 million deal example, like I'm frequently the guy who's raising $1.5 million, $2 million to buy these smaller $4 or $5 million deals. But it's really a strategy. One, we can provide great returns to our LPs, and it's a bit of a differentiated investment option for folks to invest in kind of sub-institutional scattered site deals where we're securing discounted pricing. All of that is a nice complement to playing in the institutional space because they're almost two entirely different businesses. And, but for me, I'm very clear with my objective. It's like, I'm going to do these until I personally have the financial ability to run a business where I'm the exclusive, the individual who's buying these deals, unless I'm going after, you know, 100 plus unit deals where it actually really does. There is a real economic value to syndicating those deals and having a meaningful percentage of the carried interest, but you got to walk before you can run. Right. So it's, I'd rather do those when you have a personally, right. Until you have a really meaningful percentage of that. But nevertheless, I want to switch gears because I want to dive into your story again. So, you leave Cardone Capital, you strike it on your own, and let's talk about the first deal or what that approach was initially. One, you know, your mindset, what was the criteria? Yeah. What were you searching for? Maybe types of properties, you know, the markets that you were looking in. And then how'd you actually get that first one done and closed?
Yeah. So I thought that I could raise $5 million for my first deal at 24. That's what working there does to your brain.
Desensitize you to the
yeah. So I had a big ego check out of the door when my buy box was 24 to 48 units in Tampa, Orlando, Daytona, pretty much anywhere in the Southeast. But
and you live in Tampa.
I was our office, we just signed a new lease for 1,200 square feet. I'm super happy actually going to paint it. I want to paint it. I want to be the person that paints it. I should have hired it out, but I think it's cool. So, you know, it's like my general buy box, 24, 48. As soon as I'm leaving, I'm sending an email to every single broker that I know. The email goes to the tune of, hey, my name's Gabe. I just quit working for Cardone Capital. I raised $100 million there. And now I'm looking to do my first 24 to 48 unit. I can raise X amount and X, you know, I was selling myself to the brokers. That was really important. I leveraged Grant's name and I thought I could raise some money. And so I turned my deal flow on. That was on market. At this point, I didn't really discover how we can source off-market deals. I start to look at deals. Deal flow comes in, and I leave. My last day at Grant's office was Feb 1 of 2022, and I get this email, new deal, new listing, Daytona Palms, 55 units in Daytona Beach on Feb 4, 4 days after I left. New deal comes, and I'm like, all right. It's 55 units, a little bit bigger than I was looking for. They're townhomes, so it's got some pretty cool character. And each of them, every single one of them have privately fenced 16 feet backyards. So I was like, for me, I like to buy properties with character, something that's not 600 square feet, popcorn ceiling, feels like a prison feel. You know, I like to have a story to tell to the resident. It was $8.5 million was guidance price. I was like, yeah, ha, I don't know. I think I can raise $5 million. I definitely don't have the REO schedule, and I definitely don't have the net worth to satisfy an $8 million deal. I knew I was going to leave Grant's office. This is the thing that most people won't tell you. I knew I was going to leave. I knew I was going to go buy deals. Concurrently, while doing this, it would behoove me if I'm not planting seeds with potential operators and potential partners as I'm meeting them and servicing them inside of Cardone Capital that are active and going out and doing it. I probably have two or three people that I could call on that have the net worth, have liquidity, and actually operate deals that would partner with them, that like me enough, trust me enough, and want to give me the opportunity and kind of start my career. That's the only way you're going to get into a syndication. And most of the time, it's got to be like, I like you enough, I want to give you this opportunity. I partnered with Ken. His name's Ken Gee. That's KRI Partners. I reached out to Ken. The deal was too small. He has a pre-committed fund. He's been doing it for 25, 30 years. He's one of the guys that he's gone full cycle a lot. If you're in Florida, you know Ken. I reached out to him. He's looking at 100 to 200. He's under contract on another $40 million deal in Bradenton, but he has this excess bit of equity that it's not big enough where he can go buy another big deal and he needs to place it. I'm like, interesting. So I kind of solved the problem with them. It was easy enough because he's managing other stuff in Daytona. It was easy to fit in from the operational side of it. And, you know, he kind of wanted to give me the shot. So his fund backstops the equity. I committed. It was a four-ish million dollar equity rate. I think it was 3.8, just round up to four. 4 million of total equity for it. We ended up closing that deal at 58% levered. 387 fixed money with full term interest only. And we did that deal. We locked that deal up, the loan, in February of 2022, right before the first rate hike in March. That was one of the last deals that closed right before the rate hike crisis. I raised $1 million. I probably pitched it to 50 or 60 guys that were all, they were on social media. This is a small following. Friends, families, and super close people that I've built relationships with just from being at the events, or just people like to be friends with people that are close to Grant. That's really how I got the first deal done, which is, again, why I like it. Much easier to do an 8-unit deal than it is a 55-unit deal.
Yeah, 100%. But it's fun to talk about the bigger ones, right? I mean, this is a great story. Yeah, and I mean, it's obviously things happen really quickly for you. Yeah, in terms of like...
Oh, yeah. From timeline, I think everything happens on purpose for a reason. I'm a big believer in manifestation and the universe. I don't know. I thought it was cool that we quit on Feb 1 and we got the email on Feb 4. By the way, we bought that deal from Ned Roberts, Marcus Millichap, Tampa office, the same Marcus that I started at and the same team that I was with.
That's great. So, you know, I like to get into I'm an operator, right? And I won't necessarily drive this conversation down that road too significantly, because I think I also want to get into your capital raise funnel, which I think is going to be a valuable topic for us to discuss. But
yeah, that deal's kicking ass, just so you know. But all of our deals. Any questions you want about operations, I'll answer them too. We're performing very well, and I'm happy. You know, if we weren't performing well, I think I wouldn't be as open as it.
Yeah, no, of course. But I'm curious. So obviously you mentioned Ken, right? He's vertically integrated. He's an operator, right? He has the infrastructure. He's got the folks, he's got the staff. Multi-decades worth of experience, knows how to do this. When you were structuring your partnership, and maybe you don't, you know, I don't need you to get into like specifics, but just conceptually speaking, how do you actually, like, are you the one, are you hopping on an asset management call every week, or is he the one is driving the boat here? How do you actually put that together? And do you have a desire to be the operator? Like, how are you actually building your business is maybe the better question I should ask.
Yeah. So the intention behind the partnership was to learn and take care of the headaches, because it's 55 units. He doesn't want, like, he has his team. I meet with his RN once a week. It's 95% full. It's been full the entire time, and we turn 1 to 2 units a month. Like, it's a very, very, very easy deal. So there's not a lot going on. We moved rent roll from 55 to about $74,000 since we bought it 24 months ago. The game plan, and you're going to call me, I guess, is we just bought a really good deal from the seller. We moved rents about $300 across the board, and we've done very, 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 very light, minimal work to the deal. We thought that we would have to go in and put in unit washer dryers in each of the units and do a little bit nicer of an upgrade. Everything else in the market is Class A stuff. We're the only townhome with a backyard. All of the Class A stuff is at $2,000. We took over with an average rent of $1,008, and our business plan was to take it to $1,400 by doing a super crazy renovation plan. We just tested. We got in there. We said, let's just test. Let's see before we start spending money. We got $1,400 without doing a thing, and then we got $1,500 without doing a thing. So we got in, we planned on spending the money, and we're not. And so we're purposely, like, we're ready, we're getting prepared to sell. Like, we're painting the rent roll in a certain way for the next guy. There's just not that much that we needed to do on that deal. That, from the structuring of the partnership, it was, in the syndication side of it, there's so many different ways to structure the GP side. And that's why I don't, you know, like, separating it out between a key principal or asset management and equity raise and earnest money and risk capital, like, that's cool and all. Ken and I just did it based on equity raised. There's $4 million total. $3 million came from his fund. $1 million came from me. He gets 75% of the 20. I get 25% of the 20. Yeah. And then our wife and I put $50,000 into it. That was a super easy, like, I like that, simple. The intention was to learn operations from the get-go and take care of a lot of the headaches. So to answer your question, yes, I don't want to be just a capital raiser. Is it my entry? Is it my way in? Because I know how to do a marketing fund. Yeah. I really, like, the deeper I've gotten into the operations, the less open I've been about capital raising, because it's a very scary tool if you get really good at it and you don't know what you're doing or you don't know the deals that you're going into. Yeah. So the building of the business is our equity. It's kind of like vice versa from what most people, like, they'll get good at operations first and then find the equity second. I found the equity first. Now I'm getting better at operations. So I'm partnering strategically with very experienced operators so I can compress the operating learning curve down to I don't want to say I'm really good now, but I can tell you the last 2 years is compressed, probably a 10-year career of trying to do it slowly and by yourself. So hopefully that provides some insight. I partner with two people, Ken. I partnered with him on the first deal, and then the last deal we just closed on, we bought brand new, is 2023 product. And we can go in the details about this is one of the recession deals, because we just closed on it 2 weeks ago. Brand new 2023 product for a purchase price that I can't say, 102 units in St. Pete, Florida. And we bought it at a tax and insurance adjusted 5.75, maybe a 570 cap rate going in. And we financed it with 580 money fixed for 7 years, full-term interest only. That deal 2 years ago would have traded for a 3-cap. I am very certain for that. So yeah, I don't know.
For sure. I know Tampa well enough because we own some stuff in Florida, you know, specifically Central Florida over in Lakeland and in that neck of the woods. Yeah. I mean, I know I'm familiar with the deal that you bought, not because I was pursuing it, but just from what you've shared. And yeah, it was definitely a, you know, Class A product, newly built, that's trading for in the threes without a doubt. I want to ask you a quick question on the Daytona one, just because I might get into your mindset a little bit here.
Yes.
You mentioned you're gearing up to sell that, but you have 385, I believe you mentioned, debt for 7 years. Reason to sell? Is that
I should clarify. Yeah, we're not going to sell anytime. We're not going to sell in the next 6 to 12 months. I'll tell you that for sure. 100%. Can the rent roll and can the NOI be there and ready to rock and roll? Yes. When I say ready to sell, I should say we're no longer spending $12,000 a unit to get this rent increase right here. So instead of taking that money and putting it there, we're going to not renovate it, and we're going to take it $150 or $200 instead of getting the full $400. So we can, you know, leave a little for the next guy. We've hit our rent. Well, so like for the metrics from the upside, I look at rent roll and I look at NOI. They'll kind of dictate. The rent roll's top of it, NOI is bottom. So what happens between the middle? We bought 375 or 380 of NOI. We moved it to a T1 basis of close to 600. So like we're now we just have to get it to show up on a T6 or a T12. in Florida, I've seen people trade off of a future T1. Today, you're seeing stuff on like a T6 to a T12 trade. Mm-hmm. So that's what I'd say is like our business plan is like done, not done, done, but on the way down. Yeah, I need to try. I need the full cycle. I need something on my tracker.
There we go. Like,
yeah, 100%.
Yeah. Which makes sense. Because it's like some people are like, why would I sell something where I got dead in the threes? And, but that makes sense. Yeah.
A track record, investors want to redeploy capital. I mean, they don't want to sit. It's a 3 to 5 year liquidity event. There should be some type of liquidity event on a big syndication deal. There should be redeploy money into another deal, whether it's refinance, let it grow, or just complete sale. Not a lot of people love to stick their money in a deal for 10 years and get six.
Yeah, for sure. And that makes total sense. I want to touch on a couple of different things before we hit our time here. So let's talk about the your funnel. I want to ask you a couple of questions about that. Then I want to talk about what you're seeing in Florida, where we can talk about your new deal and then some of the other deals you're pursuing, because you're a Florida investor who, I mean, Florida's a different market than the rest of the country.
I'm sure people have many questions. Insurance is the number.
Sean, which I'm also on the other end of too, because we have a building down in Florida as well, and we're in the throes of it. So we could talk about that for a bit. But let's talk about your funnel. So we could go any number of different ways with this, but I'd like you maybe to describe how you've crafted your funnel. It may be an interesting component because you also have an educational community, right? So there's some symbiote. I'm sure there's a symbiotic relationship there.
Yeah.
But like, how are you getting people on your list? How are people finding you? Like, how are you approaching the growth of the top of it, right? Yeah. And then I guess working folks down into individuals that'll wire you 50 grand when you have your next deal.
Yeah. So I should probably start with a context saying I am not revamping, but improving and growing the funnel in many different ways today. And I've learned all of what we're doing today is because of what we learned over the last 12 months or 18 months of doing it. We started with a free course targeting anybody and everybody that is interested in multifamily. What we found is there's a lot of not low-hanging fruit, but a lot of tire kickers and just time wasters and people that actually have no money and have no idea, like have no interest at all. They're just scrolling, browsing. Okay, perfect. And then we find people that are the active, like fix and flippers, wholesalers, people that are in the real estate industry that they want to move into the smaller JV deals. And then we found that some of them are business owners and some of them are busy making money in different avenues. And so we have a qualification form. If you go to our free thing, I pay $3 right now for email, phone number, how liquid you are. You got to give me the information on how liquid you are and how much real estate you own. That's the only data that I get on the front end. Now, if you're qualified, then I put you down a different funnel that says, hey, we should book a call and we should schedule a call to see whether or not you'd be a good fit for an active investor or a passive investor. That's kind of that's where the sales process comes in, because it's, we could send people that technically are accredited and would be a great fit to be an LP down directly to LP, but we might miss them over here. And then vice versa. A lot of the people that go active end up becoming passive because it's just hard and it's not meant for everybody. But I do think that regardless, if you're an active or passive investor, you should get educated. You should have a baseline education, the deal that you're going into and the operator that you're putting money with. So the funnel works as a very large cast. We've given it out to 40,000 people since we launched it. I'd say we have 1,800 to 1,900 accredited investors of that have actually been funneled into the Bowling Capital CRM for just the PE deals. And last deal we had, I don't know, probably 1.2 million that was new investors coming into it. Never invested with them before, found them off of a Facebook ad and just nurturing relationships. That's something I didn't do great. That I learned from. I should have done more updates, more market updates, not push the deal room to learn and make money there, but hey, here's what's going on overall in the market. Here are the deals that I'm looking at. Here's what I'm seeing, from an activity standpoint in the trades. That's a mistake that I made. But overall, that's the funnel. We have a free course, goes to a qualification page, goes to book a call. We pick the ball up from there. There's different ways that you can go about it. It just depends on what level of scale you're playing at. Because we talk to probably 100 to 200 people a day. We have a team of 4 right now on phones. And one of them is, you know, real estate guy. He'll take on real estate and then pass over to me. I still think it's really important for me to talk to the investors and have the relationships with them.
100%. Yeah. No, I mean, it's very interesting because I also see the content that you share on Instagram, right? Where you're like, you know, X amount of individuals have signed up for our course. Excuse me.
Oh yeah.
That's more general in real estate education, which I think a lot of the folks that are trying to build their email list as it relates to specifically attracting and nurturing LPs, their mm-hmm. content speaks to the specific mindset of what they believe to be an LP to be, right? The 8 reasons, and this is ours, so I'm making fun of myself. 8 reasons why, you know, busy X, right? Sales professionals, real estate professionals, business owners should consider passively investing in real estate. Whereas oftentimes LPs start as folks that want to be active. And this is really these are most of the people that are participating in my deals. They're people that they either are actively investing, but they like to diversify by throwing smaller chunks of cash in other people's deals. Yep. They're already a real estate professional, whether that's a broker, a house flipper, a mortgage broker, what have you. And they just invest. They don't need to know why this makes sense. They already know it makes sense.
Yeah.
Or it's somebody that wanted to build an active portfolio and it's a 30-year-old sales guy making good dough that wants to go buy a rental, but they live in Boston and they can't afford to do that in Boston. So they go and invest 50 grand into passively into a deal. But a lot of what you're describing addresses a more general net. And it also, I think, works for you because you have a couple of different ways to monetize.
Yeah, we have different places to put them. If you're only doing raising capital, I think niching down at the beginning is what you have to do, because that's the only reason. Like, if you can get a group of somebody and then attract a group of the exact same somebody, it's how you build momentum and build leverage. Being at Grants, you learn different approaches. And because of the way that we built out the entire ecosystem, we just have different buckets to place them in.
100%.
Everybody.
And that makes total sense. But I think that's an interesting approach, because not a lot of people are pushing traffic to an online course, even if it's a small, quick one, quick, free, very simple program.
We've found that most of them don't log in. Like, almost 80% of the people never even log in, because it's free. There's no commitment. We've split tested charging $7, $27, and $97. The person that takes out the card and just puts $7, like the actual act of taking a card out for $7 is like commitment versus free. It's insane. But I would niche down. I see a lot of people, like medical professionals, hey, only going after medical professionals, or I'm going after the 25 to 30 year old tech guys that are making 200 grand a year.
Yeah. And we both know Sam Silverman, and that's, that might've been how we got connected. Yeah. But he, you know, is the textbook playbook, right? And he talks about this a lot, and he's got a community, and he's raised money for some of my deals, and I've known him for a long time. And it's like, I got a bunch of sales guys in my network. I'm going to niche down very narrowly into serving them. And then when you start to hit some level of momentum or scale, you can broaden your focus. Yeah. And that's where he's at now. And also the snowball starts to roll to a point to where your referrals start to take you out of where you originally started.
You don't need more than 20 people. You really don't need more than 10 people. Like, the first deal was 11 people. The second deal was 12 people. And the last deal was 22 people.
Yeah, 100%. Well, this is great, man. Let's talk about Florida real quick before I get you out of here, because this is a personal topic that's interesting to me. And I'll set the stage for maybe any new listeners that aren't extremely familiar with what I got going on, because it's going to relate to the questions I ask you.
Yeah.
Like, I live in Boston. We invest throughout New England, primarily in New Hampshire, which is an hour north of Boston. New England has seen absolutely zero signs of any distress over the last 24 months. No distress. In New Hampshire, rents grew 11% in 2023. Pricing has not come down at all since rates started to increase. And a big reason is that NOI has continued to grow, maybe not in a commensurate as rates have grown, but it's grown at enough of a pace to where people still see the long-term benefit of investing in multifamily, because New England in general is a very supply-constrained market. It's very hard to build. So rents continue to increase. Even though rates have gone up, NOI has still continued to go up. So pricing has still remained relatively steady over the last couple of years. And it's just a different story than what's going on in a lot of markets in the Southeast, Southwest. And you have markets like Phoenix, where rents went the other way. They went down 8%+ because so much supply has been added. You know, markets like Austin, rents going the other way because they're building a lot of housing, which is great. And I actually personally think, on a personal level, that's a healthier economic environment to be in than what we're actually in up in New England.
Yeah.
But they're very, very different stories over the last 2 years. And we happen to see both, because we own in Florida as well, which has the added interesting dynamic of the insurance market kind of going bananas. Yes. And basically anybody that bought deals in 2020, 2021, 2022, probably underestimated what their insurance cost was going to be. And that line item on their P&L has gone up a little bit more than they thought it would be. And if they didn't buy right and rents haven't grown and they're not hitting their rent numbers, they might be in some trouble. And then you compound that with a lot of people using floating rate debt, which doesn't sound like something that you were, that you did, and wasn't something that we did in our deal. So we're not facing that challenge there.
Yeah.
But in general, and I guess I'm speaking kind of broadly here.
Yep.
What are you seeing in Florida right now as it relates to where you're finding opportunity? Because I'm sure you're receiving all the broker email or the emails from brokers, and you're receiving all the blasts and all of that stuff. What exactly are you noticing in the marketplace right now as it relates to where you're maybe finding pockets of opportunity, and where are you focusing your time on the acquisition side?
Yeah. So I will say for Florida deals, I am in a like hanging around the rim has never been more important than it is today. And the reason I say that is like I've been in three different I'll get a phone call from Franklin Street. And they'll call me on a deal that they're having a conversation with the seller who's in trouble. Like it's the golden goose egg deal that you want to hear about of like, hey, this guy bought in 21 or bought in 22 and insurance got him and interest costs got him. And the deal is a great deal. They hit their business plan, but they're going to lose $1 million on it. And so before they take it out to market, they want me to go and kind of find like the best qualified buyer for it and see if we can just get something without having to go through the whole shabam. I've gotten that call a lot more today on the 30s, 40s, and 50s with the retail syndicators that have never done it before that are out. I don't know, you know, you can take it for whatever you want. I don't want to talk bad about it, but it is what it is. Like people are losing money today. Oftentimes we can't get to an agreeable price because treasuries are moving 50 basis points every two weeks. And so what ends up happening is they take it out to the market and then the market says the exact same thing that I said, but 60 to 90 days kind of went by and then treasuries went up another 50 basis points. And now expectation is here and now I can actually pay here. A lot of like the Levi, that deal, this is a perfect example. That deal came out September 5th. Of 2023. We didn't close it till March 19th of 2024. It was a long period of time that went by. They brought it out. They didn't like the price that we got to them. We didn't like the price that the market spoke and gave to them. And then they brought it back off and tried to refinance it. Treasuries went up again. Values went down. Refinance didn't make sense. They brought it back out. We ended up getting that deal locked up and closed for $4.5 million less than what they initially brought it out to the market for. I think that's a fantastic opportunity in comparison to one where they brought it out to and then where it would have traded 3 years ago. So I see a lot of opportunities on 21, 22 product. The hardest part is getting that deal awarded at a price that makes sense because you'll find out what price makes sense for you. And if you're buying the smaller 30s and 40s and 50s, you're also competing against the other, I call it dumb money, like the other people that aren't really doing as much homework as they should, but want to call themselves a syndicator. I get beat out by number one, two, or three people. And I know them all. They're all in the groups and the people that I play against. That's what happens. On-market stuff. Seller finance deals are the only deals that get closed right now. Off-market, the unit, like the mom and pop that has no idea anything that's going on. Hey, I want to sell my prop. What can I get for it? I'm like, perfect. Like the 10-unit deal in Ocala. I like those. That's a sweet little deal. Other than that, not a lot. Insurance is whacking everybody. And a lot of the people that have to do anything, they're waiting for a Fed decrease so that the broker can start to say, hey man, the Fed's done. We're like, you should pay this cap rate because it's already going down. That's what a lot of smart sellers are waiting for because they see how competitive the buyer pool is for Florida. So it's a tough market to transact in whenever you're focused on like returns. That's why I've been turned on to the Midwest. That deal, I did 152 unit portfolio out in the Midwest in Missouri. That deal is performing extremely well. We bought that seller finance, two owners, 84, 85 years old. It's a $7.75 million transaction. It's 50 grand a unit. Average rents were 614. We just signed a lease at 975 plus 55 bucks of water bill back. We're going to kick butt on that. We're going to refinance and pull out 2x on the refi. and then keep them in. So I like turns. Like, that's the business that we're in. If you want to build a real estate business and at any point in your career want to raise money from investors, your job is to allocate capital to the best returns with the least amount of risk. That's it. Not look cool on Instagram, but like actually perform, do good, provide great returns. That's your only job.
Yeah. And I think even if you are enthusiastic about buying in Florida, right, and you love the long-term prospects of the state, which I think everybody would be in agreement that, yes, people are going to continue moving to Florida. A lot of the fundamental metrics will continue to look good. But it's really hard to feel comfortable with underwriting a deal unless you have really, you have long-term focus, a lot of patience, you have great operations on the ground, you have the ability to kind of bend with the market as it relates to, you know, well, I should back up and say, obviously operations are important, but a lot of the people that are running into trouble too are the ones working with third-party management companies where their cost of management's higher. They're at the whim of a third-party provider for the most important part of the business plan. And it's really hard to underwrite what insurance is going to be. And it's hard to underwrite how
possible our insurance.
And it's hard to underwrite what your exit cap should be in a market that's constantly moving, both as it relates to where debt is and as well as what the operational expense side of the portfolio or the P&L looks like, you know?
Yeah.
Whereas in the Midwest or New England or the West Coast, it's like a little bit more consistent. So there's a little bit more confidence in doing transactions. That's why pricing continues to stay strong, I think, in those areas.
For our underwriting, this is how I size almost everything up, generally speaking, like bigger deals. 65% fixed leverage from Fannie and Freddie to cover a 125. Can I get 65 and cover at your pricing takeover NOI? Insurance, if it's post 1990 or post 1995 and it's anywhere near the water, we're at least minimum baseline $2,000, probably closer to 2,500 along the coast and past 1995. If it's wood, it's going to be even greater. Rent increases have to be like you take over the property day one. If you do the renovation, what is the amount that you're going to get on that lease? Whatever that is, you have to have a rent stack, the probability of you getting that number. It should either be proven in place today on your rent roll or your certainty level has to be like at an all-time high and no more rent growth. No 3 or 4%. Maybe you can get one. Like we underwrote 1% in our Levi deal. We'll probably get more. Rents are falling flat in most markets, and there's a lot of oversupply in Florida. So the question is, what are real rents on the best, nicest, and newest brand new product? And then all of that, everything below it is dictated by what's at the top, nicest and newest. And that's the uncertainty for rents. And then insurance. Our insurance just went up 60%. At Daytona Falls.
Yeah, well, it's on the coast too, right? So it's even more challenging.
60%, all of it. We were going to go to 7% for our distributions and we're sticking at 6.5. I'm happy because of it. We can pay out the distributions, but nobody likes paying $50,000 more in insurance when there's no difference to the property.
Yeah. Yeah, it just makes it harder to do deals, right? And then you have guys like me, right? I'm an out-of-state guy in Florida. And I've just, we can stay busy enough in our backyard doing deals, and we're doing a volume of deals that's going to keep us busy enough to where I don't need to pick my head up and start looking around elsewhere. But I would like to diversify just what we're doing, my own personal capital, our investor capital, into another market. And we did a few deals in Florida that did extremely well, and we'd like to continue buying there.
It is sick. The demand but is like, sick.
I take a step back and I'm like, I'm not entrenched enough into the weeds within Florida to adequately compete against a guy like you, right? Or anybody else that's doing deals there. Therefore, I am going to focus on where I can compete much more effectively. And when I have a little bit more confidence and market knowledge around my own underwriting, I'll probably jump back in and get back into the pool.
Just partner with something. Like find just partner.
Exactly.
That's the easiest way to get into a market. Like, I didn't understand, and I still, I think everybody can grow and learn. I don't think you stop, but like the operational efficiency that I know today from just the vendors and actually having the conversations with people that are doing the work at the property, and like it's just being in the deal, you learn so much more. Even if you're an equity partner in it, you're not the main person running point on it.
Yeah, 100%. Well, Gabe, this has been great. I want to make sure I get you out of here in some reasonable amount of time here, but
I got to do more, man. There's definitely more.
Yeah, I could go for a while, but we'll have to do this again real soon for sure. But obviously, before we get you out of here, why don't you share with the listeners where they can get in touch with you I do want to hear the story over the Instagram handle. You mentioned there was a story.
So maybe
we close with that story because sounds interesting.
So my first entry to like any business, because I've always like, when I grew up, I wanted to be a businessman and like make money and like be the rich uncle. I've never like wanted to have a kid and a family. We'll see what life looks like. I always wanted to be the rich uncle that had the cool party, that the cool house and stuff. I was a gamer. I played Call of Duty and Halo growing up. And when I was probably 15 or 16, I came across this forum to like sell gamer tags and handles online. And I forget what it's called, but I went on there and I created an account because I remember I was playing vividly and I kept getting killed by this person that had a cool name. I'm like, that's cool. That's different. I want to be different. I want to be unique, not like these all these other people with XX in their gamer tag and stuff. So I found a forum and I started flipping gamer tags. And then I transitioned into Instagram because there was a lot more money in Instagram. And so I own some really cool Instagrams, like some really cool Instagrams and really big stat pages with a lot of followers. And I got out of it because there wasn't a ton of money there, but I kept some Facebook Meta connections and I paid $1,500 for the Instagram at Multifamily. I think it's like,
worth it, man. It's like a great price.
So we're going to do the deal room. I don't think I can help you, but, or any of the listeners, just a super weird story, super weird, interesting thing. I was a gamer growing up and got into selling social media handles. That was my first entry into like making $1,000 on a flip.
Yeah, this is pretty good. This might be my favorite part of the podcast. I could talk to you. I don't know if you ever played. This is the nerd out part of this. You might even be too young. You're only a few years younger than me. If you're 26, I'm 29. But like, you rip game battles. You know what I mean? Like, I grew up on all that, and it was always fun trying to get the best.
So I own the Instagram GB. I sold it. It was the board's talking about things you shouldn't sell. I sold the Instagram at GB. I bought it for $4,000 and sold it for $10,000. I thought I was the king. I wish I would have kept it, man. That would have been dope. But
man, this is more exciting conversation than real estate. I could have gotten into this at the beginning, but anyways, that's hilarious, man. That's a great story. So folks can find you at Multifamily on Instagram, and where else can they find you?
BolinCapital.com if you're an investor, or thedealroom.io for anything else. We're going to end up sending everybody down to the deal room, but investor specific, BolinCapital.com, and then anything other, just Instagram. And I'm very active on Instagram at Multifamily.
Love it, man. This has been great. Thanks for your time.
Yeah, man. Awesome.